Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. And we're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Dan Flores. He is a writer and professor of the history of the American West at the University of Montana at Missoula. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Now, you are a historian of the American West, but it's not just the history of cowboys and Indians and people and battles, but it's the history of the land itself that you write about.
It is. I teach and write about a kind of history that's called environmental history. Which is not very old as a field, maybe 35 years or so. But there are a lot of people doing really interesting work in it. And what we're interested in most is thinking about a history that sort of goes below the level, that digs deeper, if you will, into the strata below diplomatic history, political history, wars and elections and so forth.
And so what does that mean? I mean, the land is in some way, if not eternal, it's a heck of a lot older than we are. What are the strata beneath the diplomatic history? Is it not a people thing?
It is a people thing. I mean, we sort of define this kind of history, those of us who do it, as a study of the relationship between people and nature over time. I mean, historians are interested in the passage of time. So that's kind of the way we look at it. People are there, but all those elements of nature that we think of as geology, as biology, as ecology, those are a part of it too. So it's a history that incorporates things that I think most folks who have done history in the past haven't really looked at very closely.
I was reading one of your books called The Natural West, and one of the things that struck me about it was how many questions there are. It's not a bunch of declarative sentences. You raise so many questions. And one of the questions that I thought was so interesting was, why does New Mexico seem so very different from Utah? One is Mormon, one is Spanish, Indian more. Is it because of cultural reasons that they seem so different, or are they really different lands?
Well, I think what I was trying to do with that particular question was to look at a place like the Rocky Mountain West, which stretches obviously from Canada into the Southwest, as far south as Santa Fe, and sort of consider a similar landscape in places where different cultures have occupied it. And I think the answer that ultimately that book comes to is that despite the fact that the landscape of northern New Mexico, especially the mountain landscape of northern New Mexico, is very similar to the landscape in the mountains of Utah or Montana, the places that get created end up being very different, and that's something you can attribute to culture.
So say more about those two places, New Mexico and Utah, in terms of the different cultures that settled them and the legacies that we have now.
Well, I think, you know, the first thing you have to say probably is that we've got a historical tradition in New Mexico that goes back, is traceable farther back in time than is the case in Utah. And I'm speaking of the classic Pueblo and Anasazi peoples, the ancestral Puebloan peoples. And if you look at that kind of history, then you can sort of compare the two places in terms of Indian inhabitation and occupation. And then you can do the same thing when you introduce Europeans. And you get Europeans in New Mexico a couple of centuries before they really began coming to Utah in large numbers. And that two-century difference, say, in the time between Spaniards coming to New Mexico and Mormon settlers out of the Midwest going to Utah, is a kind of a vital difference. I mean, 200 years of time produces a different kind of te- technological ability on the part of the two groups. And so just that time difference is one of the elements. And then, of course, the other one, I suppose, the more important one, is that those two groups bring two really different sorts of cultures into the West. Even though the Mormons, in a lot of ways, they sort of emulate the Spanish settlers of New Mexico. They practice irrigation. They herd livestock communally, all this being governed by the Mormon Church. So there are some similarities there, and there are similarities also in that both groups end up leaving the mountains, the high mountains, in sort of communal ownership rather than making them private. But, I mean, I think we all understand that Catholicism and Mormonism are two different religions, and so you get two different results on the land as a consequence of that.
How did each group interact with the Indians who were there when they arrived?
Well, they interacted pretty differently. There's no question about that. I think the Spaniards, of course, coming up from Mexico when they colonized New Mexico, are bringing a contingent of Hispanicized Indian people from Mexico along with them. But to a certain extent, the Spaniards don't always come as family groups. Often it's sort of a male-dominated group that comes without children, without wives. And so they're looking for wives among the local Indian population, and they find them. The Mormons, like Anglo-American settlers along the Atlantic seaboard, tend to come as family groups. And so you don't have really any intermarriage or very much intermarriage between Mormon settlers and the Indian population of Utah. I mean, that's obviously a pretty distinct difference.
One of the things that you've written about is that Thomas Jefferson, a little over 200 years ago, sent out an expedition which was not entirely unlike the Lewis and Clark expedition. I never even heard of this whole thing.
Yeah, and it's aimed at the Southwest. This is one of those episodes in American history that has been completely forgotten. But in the 2 years after Jefferson sent Lewis and Clark to explore the northern reaches of the Louisiana Purchase, he immediately, once they were in motion, began working on an expedition, assembling an expedition, to explore the southern Louisiana Purchase, which in some ways, I mean, we don't think of it now because of our focus on Lewis and Clark, but the southern boundary of the Louisiana Purchase was in dispute between the United States and Spain. France had turned the Louisiana Purchase over to the United States without clarifying the boundaries. And Jefferson argued that the southern boundary of the Louisiana Purchase was the Rio Grande River, which would have meant that the Spanish settlements in Texas and those in New Mexico were both a part of the Louisiana Purchase. Spain obviously didn't agree with that interpretation. And so Jefferson attempted to send a Lewis and Clark type expedition. It was led by civilian scientists, Thomas Freeman and Peter Custis. Freeman was an astronomer and Peter Custis was a naturalist, up the Red River, which Jefferson, I believe, thought was probably going to be a kind of a compromise boundary in case Spain really insisted that the Rio Grande wouldn't work, and dispatched that expedition in 1806. It was actually a larger expedition than Lewis and Clark. It was manned by... You know, the Lewis and Clark people don't like to hear you say this, but it's manned by people who are actually better trained than Meriwether Lewis and William Clark were. Congress appropriated twice the money for this southwestern expedition as they did Lewis and Clark. And it was, interestingly to me, and I think to anyone from this part of the world, it was really sort of aimed at Santa Fe. This was not an expedition that was going to go on to the Pacific. It was going to explore a river that Jefferson thought would lead his explorers to Santa Fe and the Southern Rockies. And then they were going to cross over from the headwaters of the Red River, which they thought came out of the Southern Rockies, to the Arkansas. The expedition is almost completely unknown in American history because of a very simple fact. Spain opposed it. sent two military forces, one from Texas and one from Santa Fe, out to oppose it, and they actually stopped Jefferson's exploring expedition about 600 miles up the Red River and basically told the Americans to turn around and retrograde to American territory.
And that's what they did.
Yeah, and that's what they did. So, I mean, the United States was a young country at the time, and it was very concerned about its reputation. And so Jefferson and the country tended to focus on the success of the Lewis and Clark expedition and pretty much kind of swept this Southwestern expedition under the rug of history. And that's where it's been ever since. I did a book on it in 1984, and that was the first book anyone had ever written on this expedition at a time when it was almost 200 years old.
Now, how long did they stay out before they returned back?
Well, they left, they departed from Natchez, Mississippi on April the 2nd of 1806, and they returned to Natchez after exploring as far up the Red River as Spain was willing to allow them to go in September of that same year. So they were gone for about 6 months. The actual exploration on the upriver part was only about 4 months, and after they were turned around, it took them about 2 months to get back.
Something I've always wondered in trying to imagine going on expeditions like that is, I mean, we're used to highways and mountain trails that are well marked and compasses and GPS devices and all that. How did they navigate? How did they know where they were and where to go? How well mapped was that territory?
Well, it wasn't well mapped, and in fact, one of the sort of intriguing things, at least to me, about this expedition is that even had it been a success, the Red River would not have led Jefferson's expedition to Santa Fe or the Southern Rockies. The country wasn't well known enough for Jefferson to realize that the river that he thought was the Red River coming out of the Southern Rockies was actually the Pecos River. And the Pecos, of course, flows south and empties into the Rio Grande. And the Red River that Jefferson assumed was going to take him into what we now know as the headwaters of the Pecos actually heads out on the high plains of eastern New Mexico and west Texas. It comes out of a grand series of canyons over on the Llano Estacado, Palo Duro Canyon in particular. So, in fact, even if this expedition had been successful and the Spaniards hadn't caught them, the expedition would have ended up sort of in the middle of nowhere, out on the plain, still 300 miles east of Santa Fe. I've often puzzled about exactly what they would have done had they ended up successfully exploring to the headwaters of the Red River. And, in fact, I was intrigued enough a few years ago. I wrote a little novella called The River That Flowed From Nowhere about what might have happened had this Southwestern expedition gotten to explore and seen the headwaters of the Red River. I think they probably would have turned around and gone back because Jefferson had told them that if they couldn't cross over to the Arkansas River, he wanted them to explore to the head of the Red River and then come back. And I think they would have, that's probably what they would have done.
Is that what happened in your novella?
That's what happened in my novella. I have them get to the western edge of the Llano Estacado in the spring and early summer of 1807. I have them spend the winter at the Wichita villages on the Red River and then explore by horseback to the headwaters of the Red River. And they get to the far western edge of the Llano Estacado Plateau, and their Indian guides say, well, Santa Fe is out there, but it's, you know, it's another 10 days ride from here. And I have Thomas Freeman consult his instructions from Jefferson and say, well, it's time to turn around and go back. So the whole thing ends up being sort of a fizzle, even if the Spaniards aren't involved.
Is there any enduring legacy from that trip? I mean, they got pushed back, but they did make it 600 miles in.
They did make 600 miles in, and I, you know, in my own work, what I've really been fascinated by is Peter Custis's, Dr. Peter Custis's natural history work, because he did a thorough enough ecological reconnaissance of the Red River in 1806 that it's possible using his work to sort of reconstruct what the ecology of the Red River was like in that particular year. So there were, I mean, looking at it from the modern perspective, there were some really beneficial results. I think at the time, though, the principal result was this ended Jeffersonian exploration in the West. He intended to send several other expeditions out. He was going to send at least four expeditions into the West, but Spain's opposition and the result of this confrontation between the Spanish army and the Freeman and Custis expedition caused Congress basically to refuse to appropriate any money for more Jeffersonian expeditions. So it kind of brought to an end this early phase of exploration of the West.
So Manifest Destiny was delayed by a few decades.
Manifest Destiny was delayed by a few decades, that's right. I've sort of used this expedition to argue, though, that it didn't require a successful Jeffersonian exploration in the West to allow Manifest Destiny to unfold the way it logically did. Even without a successful expedition, the United States still ends up getting Texas in another 30 years. And, of course, in another 40 years, the U.S. ends up getting northern Mexico, what is now New Mexico, Arizona, parts of Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and all the Pacific coast.
We're talking to Dan Flores, writer and professor of the history of the American West. Let's go back to this whole question of what environmental history is. You come from a family in Louisiana that has been in the same place for, what, three centuries?
Yeah, almost three centuries. Eight generations of us on the same piece of ground. That's kind of American history especially, that's a sort of an unusual thing.
That's a really, really long time. I mean, yeah. It's older than the history of our country. But I wondered if your connection, I mean, I assume your connection to the land from which you come really gave you your start in this whole question of environmental history and kind of land-based exploration.
Yeah, it did. I grew up, for one thing, knowing that my family had been in place for many generations, and sort of getting from those previous generations of people living in Louisiana a kind of a prepackaged sense of what the landscape was like. I mean, we had family stories about places that went back to at least my great-great-great-great-grandfather, who was sort of a minor figure in Louisiana history, but he was an Indian trader and he appears in a lot of the documents of early Louisiana colonial history. So that came down sort of as family lore, and I don't think there's any question that it pointed me a lot towards looking at the relationship between originally my family and the landscape that we occupied, and then sort of ultimately translating that into looking at the bigger picture of human beings and nature.
It seems like when you look at the American West, we have a tremendous romanticism that's reflected in paintings and some literature about the West. And you also have a tremendous pragmatism, which is about exploiting the resources of the West. Tell us about each of those strains. I don't know if they're separate and distinct or whether they blend as well.
Well, I argue in my book, The Natural West, which is a book that sort of focuses on the Great Plains and Rocky Mountains, that the American West has been, for a lot of us, a lot of different cultural groups, Native people, I think, and Europeans of all backgrounds, kind of, sort of a dream landscape. And one of the reasons I think that that's the case is because it may remind us, we may have some subliminal memories of a kind of an African genesis for us humans. And the West, I think, is in a lot of ways, especially the early West, was a real reminder of that African birth of humanity. I mean, it's a wide open landscape of prairies, plains, a blue dome of sky, and huge roaming herds of grazing animals.
So you think we have primordial memories?
Yeah, I think we do. Yeah,
very
I absolutely think we do. And so I think that's one of the reasons the West has a power over us in a way that a lot of other landscapes in North America, and I'm including the South where I grew up, don't really have. I saw the West for the first time when I was 4 years old. It was an experience that I didn't remember until I was 40. But I knew that growing up, I was always fascinated with the West. I sort of assumed that maybe as a child I had seen some especially lovely National Geographic layout or something of photographs of the West, because even when I was 7 or 8 years old, I had dreams of this sort of red canyonated landscape with a blue sky and white cotton ball clouds in it. Didn't know where that came from. I just knew I was fascinated by it. And when I was about 40 years old, at a Christmas gathering, one of my aunts was talking about when they had gone from Louisiana into New Mexico, into the Carlsbad, they had visited Carlsbad, and my mother said, oh, yeah, and speaking to me, you went. And I said, I went? How could I go? I was only 4 years old. And she said, well, we let you go along for the trip while Mom and Dad did something else. They had some other trip, maybe to New Orleans, I think, that they were going to do. And so I suddenly began to remember I'd actually seen the West.
And you think that set your life course?
I think it did, yeah. I saw it at the age of 4, and it was not a memory that I retained as a conscious memory, but it was a subliminal memory. And I think in that same way, human beings, all of us from around the world, react to the American West in a kind of a subliminal way with almost a genetic memory of our early African origins, because those two landscapes are really quite similar.
That's very interesting. I do remember the first time I came to Santa Fe many years ago. I was just a young person just out of college, and it did feel like I remembered this place even though I hadn't been here before.
Yeah.
But I figured that must have been from watching movies or something.
I think a lot of us feel that way, and no doubt some of those recognition stories come from movies or from seeing exhibits of art. My reaction, I'm in Montana at least part of the year now. I only live a part-time in New Mexico. And my first impressions of Montana were from looking at art. And when I first went to Montana, I went on a float trip down the Missouri River and woke up one morning with this spectacular sunrise at the foot of the white cliffs, raised up in my sleeping bag. The sun was hitting these white cliffs. Waterfowl were flying down the Missouri River. Mule deer were bounding out across the hills. And I suddenly realized, I hadn't even thought of it before, I've seen all this before. I've seen it in paintings by people like Carl Bodmer and George Catlin.
Right.
So I think that happens to a lot of us too. But, you know, I've got no way really to demonstrate it scientifically, but I have a very strong hunch that this subliminal thing is a part of the mix too.
We're talking to Dan Flores. So there's this subliminal thing, and maybe that's responsible for some of the response that many people have to the incredible beauty and deep feeling that's associated with the landscapes of the West. Then there's also this thing of destroying the land that we live on. Why do we do this?
Well, you know, I think for one thing, we're biological, and every species alters the habitat in which it lives, and we're no different. We can't help from doing that.
Every species. I mean, we're talking about ants and mosquitoes and dogs.
Absolutely. Every single species has an impact on the habitat that it finds itself in. And so no matter how well adapted we are, we always need space. We need air. We need resources. We're going to need fuel. We're going to need energy. We're going to need things from the world. And because we're biological and organic, we're not ever going to be able to escape that. I think part of the the destructive capability of humans has to do with we tend to be short-term thinkers. We think in terms of immediate gain. We've long been engaged with nature in a kind of a give and take where we're trying to create a sort of a good life for ourselves. And that good life, when you think in terms of short-term gain, often means that we use up resources at a pace that aren't sustainable. And I think, you know, that the truth really is we haven't known how nature works for very long as a species. I mean, we've known some things.
As if we still do.
Well, that's exactly right. As if we still do. We obviously don't know yet how it works, but I think we're farther along in understanding it. And the science of ecology, of course, has been one of the great breakthroughs in enabling us to understand how the natural world works. But, I mean, that's part of it, is when you don't exactly know what the result of your actions are going to be, then you can do things that produce unintended ecological consequences and be completely oblivious to that.
Now, this is something that human cultures have been doing for tens of thousands of years.
I think we've been doing it from the very beginning. And, in fact, one of the reasons, no doubt, that we ended up leaving Africa and spreading around the world was because we used up resources in local places. And so there was always pressure to move, to seek out new locations where other humans hadn't been before. I think this in part accounts for our sort of fantasy imagination about exploration and about being the first people on a landscape, sort of doing the Adam and Eve kind of thing. And we've, as we spread out of Africa 40,000 years or so ago and around the world in the last 40 or 50,000 years, one of the things that drove that was the search for landscapes where humans had not already exploited the resources.
In your work, it's a theme that comes up is this nature of human beings. We do what we do, which, you know, transcendent of culture. Yeah. But there's also real cultural influences on how we use and how we view the land. I mean, some cultures are more respectful of the land and some are more exploitive of it. What are some of the roots that you see in the various strains of American culture in both of these directions?
Well, I think, first of all, my argument about humans in nature is that it springs from the premise, first of all, that we are biological, and that also that we are remarkably the same around the world. Human biology is rather astonishingly similar from one group to the other. I mean, and there are evolutionary
reasons.
Well,
identical reasons. From one.
Yeah, literally group to the identical other. From one group to the other.
But that doesn't mean there aren't cultural differences.
That you're exactly right, and so. What those of us who start with the premise, first of all, that we are biological and that we're virtually identical from one group to the other would argue is that what's really happening is that there's kind of a biocultural phenomenon at work in sort of directing how humans exist, how we exist within landscapes. And so, in effect, culture is kind of this overlay. It's almost like we're M&Ms, you know, and we've got a soft candy center and a hard shell exterior, and that hard shell exterior comes in all kinds of different colors, those colors being analogous to culture. And each one of those, of course, as we eat an M&M, each one of them tastes a little bit different to us. And that's sort of the way cultures are in interacting with nature. Each one does things a little bit differently from the other. So culture kind of mediates this biological imperative that we have as a species. And you're exactly right. Some cultures have worked out a means by which they live fairly sustainably.
Like who? Who would be an example of that?
Well, I mean, I think here locally, the Pueblo peoples are one. I think if you look back in Pueblo and Indian past, you can find times when, for example, Chaco Canyon, it looks as if probably the Chacoan phenomenon may be overstretched resources And, of course, drought contributed to the demise of Chaco. But the point I want to make about it is not so much to try to explain what happened to Chaco in terms of its fall, but the conclusions that the Puebloan people drew from that collapse and retrenchment. I think they learned things that, as a result of their prior experiences, that enabled them to live more sustainably on the landscape of the Southwest. And so over a very long period of time of living in the same location with this sort of packaged, pre-adapted set of memories about how you do this on a much bigger scale, something like my own family has done in Louisiana, living in the same spot over eight generations, I think they were able to draw on the knowledge of one generation after another in understanding how to live within the constraints of the landscape. And they learned from the mistakes they had made in the past. And by living in the same place generation after generation and observing it carefully, the feedback loops were short. I think one of the distinctions you can draw between a people like that and we modern Americans is that we've been here so briefly that we don't have a lot of those built-in kind of safeguards to understanding how the world around us works.
Well, one of the questions that arises when you say this, that people learn from their mistakes and they were really able to change and pass down their knowledge, was what was the form in which they passed down their knowledge? I mean, it wasn't through books.
No, it wasn't through books. It was through oral tradition, of course, through folk stories, through winter nights, sitting around probably inside a kiva or certainly inside a pueblo and listening to stories about what had happened to previous generations. And so there was an intact oral tradition that was capable of transmitting from one generation to another this really, really fine-grained understanding of the local world.
And it also raises the question that for us, even if we do or even if we already have come to an understanding of our mistakes, people are watching, you know, like me, South Park, and not sitting around the campfire. I mean, we're not getting the knowledge that is already known.
Yeah, there's no question that the modern world, modern society in the United States we're far more detached from the natural world than we have been in the past. And we tend to learn about the natural world often by, sitting and watching the Discovery Channel. And maybe even we learn something about the natural world from watching South Park, too. But that's not the same as having that sort of, you're sitting in the sand with the wind in your hair and getting this really gritty, really tangible experience of things. I mean, we're detached enough that we're kind of getting a simulation of what nature is rather than the real thing.
We're talking to Dan Flores. I think you wrote somewhere that you thought that one of the things that we might do in the 21st century is get back in contact with our animal nature and with some of these things that you're talking about.
I hope we do. I mean, I've tried to argue in some of my books, The Natural West in particular, that it's really important for us to finally understand that we come from the earth, we come out of the evolutionary stream, we are natives and residents of the planet, and we're kin, I mean real kin, biological DNA, genetic kin to every other species around us, because all of us, all species that are alive now, have all come out of this same sort of evolutionary stream. And I think it's a good thing not to think of ourselves so much as being completely distinct from every other living thing. There have been certain cultural patterns in human history that have sort of pushed us in the direction of thinking that we were separate from everything else. And so it seems to me if we can get back in touch with the fact that we too are animals and we're a part of this whole kinship network, that it's going to be to our benefit, and not only our benefit, but probably to the benefit of other living things as well.
I have been accused on more than one occasion of anthropomorphizing my dogs, and I think sometimes we human beings do that, but I think there's a deeper thing going on, which is in fact we are like our dogs and we are like our cats and we are like a lot of other animals. And one of the ways actually that this comes out is in a project that you're working on, which is the legend of the coyote here in the West and also the animal itself, coyote.
Yeah, that's the current book I'm doing. I'm not very far along in it, but I've become really fascinated with this Native American deity and also with the little animal in our backyards, too. And so the book kind of has the twofold purpose of telling the story of both. In the case of the deity, I think the thing that really intrigues me about coyote is that in Native traditions, coyote is sort of the shaper of the world. He's responsible, for example, for the fact that salmon will be in one stream and not another, that a mountain range exists in this place and not in that place. So he really has shaped the topography of the continent. But even beyond that, the intriguing part to me is that coyote is a deity who seems to never quite be satisfied with the world as he finds it. He always wants to change it, oftentimes to make it better for human beings. And in more cases than not, his changes end up backfiring. And so he becomes kind of a comic figure, almost a buffoon figure. And in a lot of ways, I think that really describes for us the native sense of what human nature is, that we can't resist tinkering and toying with the world. But because we don't completely understand how the world works, the result of that tinkering and toying oftentimes is that it backfires on us. So I think coyote maybe is the perfect deity for the 21st century as we come to grips with our own human nature.
One of the things that you write about is the legacy of Puritanism, which really doesn't want to see us as animals at all, or if we are, if we are animals, it's kind of a bad animal, an evil animal.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's that particular sentiment is very deep in it's not only deep in religion, it's a very deep sentiment, I think, in humanism and certainly in the humanistic tradition. It's not... It's a tradition that's not really willing to embrace the positive aspects of being a part of the evolutionary stream. I mean, we tend to think, you'll hear it all the time. People will say, oh, he's acting just like an animal. Well, that ought to be a really positive thing. But in fact, anytime someone says that, it's a really awful thing to say about someone. And I think that sort of sentiment is not doing us a great deal of good in the modern world. And it does have a very deep tradition in philosophy, humanism, and religion.
One way in which we are different from all the other animals is we do things like what you do, write history, analyze things, reflect deeply over many years on the self and on the past. Do you think there... What is it in our genetic makeup as human beings, as animals, that pushes us to do that? Because it is another universal, apparently universal thing that we do.
Yeah, it is universal. It's kind of an archetype of the human experience. Someone once said that humans are the storytelling animal, and I think that may be a key to this question you just asked, because I think what we're doing is we're telling stories to ourselves with this narrative tradition, whether it's an oral tradition or writing books, because we're trying to explain the world and ourselves to one another. No other species is capable of doing that. Other species have culture, there's no question, but they don't have a kind of an oral culture, a culture of words and images and stories that they can transmit from one generation to another. I mean, there are chimps, for example, that are able to transmit tool working culture from one generation to another, but they're not transmitting stories. And so that is something I think that's unique in human beings, this storytelling tradition that we have.
Does it help us survive? Does it hasten our own demise?
Well, I would say that the jury is still out on that. We don't really know which way it's going to go. I would like to think, I tend to be optimistic about us, and I would like to think that this storytelling impulse that we have is probably the hope of humanity, that we're going to ultimately tell the right stories to enable us to live in the world in a sustainable way. And so I think it's a positive thing. But who knows?
When you look at the history of the West and you look at the incredible exploitation of the land that we've had in so many different ways, you know, across the Rocky Mountains and so on, there's a lot of restoration work going on now. What is the nature of that restoration work? What are we trying to restore to?
Very interesting question. I've argued in some of my work that in American environmental history, the environmental history of the United States, we have sort of gone through a progression where in the 19th century, what we were really trying to do in the West was to come to terms with land ownership and who owned the land, and ended up leaving good percentages of the land in most Western states in a kind of public ownership, which was the origin of things like the national forests, the national parks, ultimately BLM lands. That was sort of the 19th century and very early 20th century thrust of environmental history in the West. Then in the late 20th century, we began thinking in terms of creating a wilderness preservation system where we took some of these national forests or national parks and tried to preserve what we thought was the last few remaining parcels of wild land that was mostly or reasonably untouched by humanity, so that we could kind of have vignettes of the primal world. I mean, both of these historical traditions came with a lot of questions and a lot of problems, and it produced a lot of political fallout. But I think in our own century, it seems to me that the trend is towards restoration. We're trying to go back and reevaluate, for instance, whether or not putting dams on a place like the Snake River was a really smart thing to do. I mean, we ended up destroying salmon runs. We ended up destroying wild river systems and totally altering water flows in the Pacific Northwest. Of course, we ended up also creating reservoirs and dams that were very beneficial to human culture and human populations. But there were really dramatic losses for the natural world. So one of the things that's happening now is that we're starting to rethink whether or not some of those things were necessary. And restoration has involved things like taking dams out of places like the Snake River Canyon, really trying to consider whether or not, say, Glen Canyon Dam on the Colorado River is something that we forever will want to be there. And I think it's extended to things like trying to reintroduce wolves to the northern Rockies and to the southwest after we literally obliterated them from the United States 75 or 80 years ago. It extends to trying to recover native grasslands when many of those were plowed up to the point that they almost became invisible in the world, recovering buffalo populations. So that restoration theme, I think in some ways, is a time for us to sort of look back at what we've done and be really self-critical and say, well, not everything we did was necessarily something to celebrate. Maybe we should go back and do some readjustments.
We are individuals living in society. Each cell in our body is an individual cell that's part of the larger organism of ourselves. Are we people part of a larger organism known as society?
Yeah, that's one of those mega questions, too.
And we have 2 minutes left.
And we have 2 minutes left. You know, I think that there may be some merit to thinking of society as a kind of a superorganism. You know, there is, of course, the Gaia hypothesis about Earth, that Earth and all its life forms is a living entity, this blue, green, white ball hanging in space, and seen from the perspective of vast distances out in the void, it looks like a single organism. It looks like something that is alive and breathing and self-adjusting. And in that kind of view, it's almost as if each one of us is an individual cell of that gigantic superorganism that's the planet. I think you can probably look at human societies, at communities, almost in the same way. And some people, some scientists and some people who aren't scientists have tried to interpret human history in that way. That's a little unfamiliar to most of us because we tend to think in terms of, as you mentioned, we're individuals. We have our own individual desires and lives and experiences, and they're different from everyone else's.
And at most, families.
Yeah, and at most, right, families. Usually we'll think of the family unit as something that's kind of an organic thing, but it's each family unit then is distinct from the other. But the farther away you get from the individual experience, the more it all seems to blend together. And I think in the 1960s, when we first began to get photographs of Earth from space, was really the dawning of this notion that maybe this whole thing is just a gigantic superorganism. It's an interesting way to look at it.
Well, on that note, unfortunately, we have to go. But I want to thank you very much for being here with us, Dan Flores, on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's my pleasure.
Dan Flores is a writer and professor of the history of the American West at the University of Montana at Missoula. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.